Anyone who's listening who thinks that this episode is disorganized, it's completely my fault. So for various reasons, but I'm taking full responsibility. Welcome to Star's End, a Foundation podcast. This is a podcast dedicated to the Foundation universe, both the classic novels written by Isaac Asimov and the upcoming adaptation from Apple Plus. I'm John, and I'm your co-host.
My name is Dan, and I'm also the co-host. We're going to read Asimov's novels together and talk about how they look from a 21st century perspective. We'll also talk about show news as it comes out, and when season one airs later in 2021, we'll talk about each episode.
And I'm Joseph. All three of us are middle-aged white guys who read the Foundation novels as teens, but we're not here to gatekeep, just the opposite. After all, Foundation is about how societies must evolve or die, and we want to help hand this story off to a younger and more diverse audience.
So this week we're going to talk about the first half of Second Foundation, the end of the Mule's story. But first, we're going to have a little bit of trivia. And we're going to toss it over to Joseph, who's going to ask me some trivia questions. But we seem to have lost Dan.
I think we may have.
Which again, Dan being the host.
I just turned off my video so that I wouldn't
bother me with the corn on the cob. Yeah. All right, well, I'm going to have to do some editing here.
You have no idea what he's going to eat next.
I've got only knows. I don't want to know. All right. All right, Joseph, what do you got for me?
Okay, so
is there a theme to these questions?
The theme to the questions are Asimov short stories.
Okay.
Okay, and so I've got seven questions here. Basically, I will describe a short story.
Yeah.
And then I want you to give me the title. Oof. For partial credit, if you don't have the title, you can tell me. You can tell me enough about the story that I can tell you know which story I'm talking about.
Okay, I'm gonna give it a shot.
Okay, very good. All right, so these sound like Jeopardy questions, so you may feel free to answer in the form of a question, but it's not required.
Okay.
Okay, and the other thing I'll say is there are seven questions. We usually do six questions, so you may pass on one of them.
All right then.
Okay, so are you ready?
I'm ready. Fingers crossed, I'm ready.
Okay. Number one, this Asimov short story led the voting when it was chosen for inclusion in the Science Fiction Hall of Fame.
I'm going to say Nightfall.
That is correct.
Whew. All right, okay. I'm not going to get shut out. It's great.
One out of one. All right. This story is about a Neanderthal boy who is brought into the present to be studied.
I don't think I read that one. So I'm going to have to say I don't know.
Okay. So that one is The Ugly Little Boy.
Yeah, no. We're going to find out how little Asimov I've actually read through the course of this.
Well, these are actually just these things. These are things that I happen to have read. And,
okay.
And, you know, there's so much Asimov. I mean, who knows?
There is a lot. Yeah, he did write a lot of short stories.
Okay. He did. Okay. So number three, this is a story of Norman Mueller voting in the 2008 presidential election.
Again, I don't know that one.
Okay, that one is called Franchise. And it's, I find that one interesting for a couple of reasons. The sort of the punchline of the story, although he gets to it in the middle, is that there is one and only one voter. And I kind of see some parallels between that and psychohistory, because it's kind of doing reductio ad absurdum on statistical reasoning. Yeah, okay. The one voter, they come in, they interview him, and then based on his answers, they decide who would have won, who statistically model who would have won the election.
Based on the one guy.
This story received more requests than any other to be included in anthologies. It's about a schoolgirl reading about classrooms in the past.
Oh, I know this one. But I'm drawing a complete blank on it, so I'm gonna miss it again.
So you can't. No, I can't.
I'm sorry.
That's okay.
I feel like
that's
I have to apologize.
That one was called The Fun They Had.
Yeah.
And sort of timely because at the moment, because of course it's a, you know, her schooling is highly computerized, and you know she was reading wistfully and you know nostalgically about all these kids in the past who got to, you know, be in a classroom together and run around and play, and that just sounded wonderful.
I'm being exposed for how long it's been since I read Asimov short stories, but
yeah,
let's move on.
Okay, let's move on. All right, number five. This is one of Asimov's few stories that involves extraterrestrial intelligence. There's an alien hive mind who tries to take over the Earth.
And it's a short story.
It's a short story. So it's not Foundation's Edge.
An alien hive mind who tries to take over the Earth. Nope, I'm not going to be able to answer that one either.
Okay, that one's called Green Patches.
Dan, would you be doing better at this than I? Than I've been doing? No, he's shaking his head. Okay. I got one right, though.
You got one right, so you're not shut out.
Feeling good.
All right, so how about this one?
Yes.
Asimov claimed that more fans asked him about this story than any other because the last line was so surprising they never remembered the title.
The last line was so surprising that they never remembered the title.
Yes.
It feels like I'm going to fall back on Sha Guido G as that story, but it's probably not right. No. Because the last line of that story is, for the second time, Atlantis sank beneath the waves.
Ah.
Which is a terrible pun. But anyway, go ahead. But what is the actual story?
This one's the last question. It was one of his favorite stories. And it's a sequence of vignettes of people asking the most sophisticated computer, you know, so multivac and then univac, you know, does the universe have to run down? Can we reverse entropy? The computer keeps working on it and working on it. Of course, there's a continuum of computer consciousness, I guess, in Asimov. It keeps working on it and working on it and working on it. And, you know, we're near the heat death of the universe. And then the computer finally comes up with the answer, and then it says, ah, let there be light.
I've read that story. Yeah, I cannot remember the title, but I've read this. I have definitely read that one.
Yeah, Dan, we could continue on with this next time, because I've got
millions.
Sure. I've got two things that I'm not using.
So I now am the owner of the two lowest scores in our trivia history.
I'm sorry.
Don't apologize.
And I was the one that asked him.
If I'm going to do an Asimov podcast, I should probably be up on my Asimov a little bit better. I mean, Dan, last time I asked Dan a bunch of Asimov questions, and he did extremely well on the filling in the blanks thing and the titles, and I was impressed. So I
told you I have the galactic spirit with me.
You told me you had memorized the Encyclopedia Galactica.
Yeah, that too. So go ahead. Yeah.
I was gonna say one last thing we're gonna do here. We've got one more question.
Why don't we throw that open to the audience and let them
kind of answer it? We will throw this open to the audience. You can answer it on either our Twitter feed, which is at PodsNCat at Stars End Podcast, there we go, or on our website, which is starsendpodcast.wordpress.com. So here's the final question. This story bears some similarities to Evidence, which is a story from My Robot. Was the American president assassinated, or was it his robot double?
So we're throwing that open to the audience.
Open to the audience. So then,
if I knew that one, I would not say it now because we're throwing it.
Yes.
Open to the audience.
So of course you knew that one, right?
We're going to imply heavily that I do know that one.
There you go. All right. So pretty good.
Oh, you really? Okay. So let's move on and talk about Second Foundation, unless there's some reason not to.
I'll just add, in response to the last question that Joseph mentioned, have you guys seen there's someone made a webcomic of it, adaptation of it. I don't know if you've ever taken a look at that. If not, I'll send you a link. Maybe we could put it up. It's really a well done. It's a kind of fun adaptation.
Cool.
I discovered it when I was researching that Comics Week.
Nice.
So let's throw the link up on our
site. And
we can do that.
You can all look at it.
All right, let's go ahead then.
On to Second Foundation. So when we last met our heroes, Beta Daryl had just murdered Ebling Miss with her blaster in order to keep the mule, who turned out to be Magnifico the Clown, from discovering the whereabouts of the Second Foundation. And now we have moved ahead just a few years. I think it's 5 years that we've moved ahead. And the mule has stopped expanding his empire and is desperately searching for the Second Foundation. And we get a look at an interaction between the mule and Han Pritcher, who, as we recall, is the former Foundation captain, who is now a general in the mule's forces, and described as the most valuable of all of the mule's converts from the Foundation. But he is converted and firmly emotionally controlled, as the mule assures him that if he were to lower his emotional control, he would be dead within moments, because Pritcher would kill him. And that, you know, underneath the great love that Pritcher has for the mule that is enforced by the mule's emotional control is an enormous hatred that has been enhanced by years of enforced love. And so we see the mule's interaction with Pritcher, where he tells him that he wants him to go out and try to find the Second Foundation, and also reveals to him that certain key operatives of the mules appear to have been tampered with mentally and lost all initiative, and that the mule suspects that it must be the Second Foundation that is doing this. And then we kind of get a mirror image of that in which the mule interacts with Bail Chanis, who is Bail Chanis, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Who is an unconverted member of the mule's government. And he's going to send Chanis out with Pritcher to find the Second Foundation. And he values Chanis because he is unconverted and has clearly not been tampered with by the Second Foundation. And the rest of the story is pretty much Pritcher and Chanis going out. Chanis has got this whole story about how Harry Seldon said that the Second Foundation would be established at a place called Star's End, the cryptic clue that Harry Seldon left for everybody. And Chanis has found a system called Tazenda, which appears at the end of a sort of a dust cloud only when seen from Trantor. And he has decided that this must be where the Second Foundation is. And as improbable as that sounds, Pritcher and Chanis go off. They decide actually to stop at a nearby system under the control of Tazenda, which is called Rossum. It's a little bit backward. It's a little bit icy and snowy. They land on Rossum. Long story short, Pritcher and Chanis kind of have it out because they've had this rivalry. And the mule arrives to reveal that he's known all along that Chanis has been an actual member of the Second Foundation. They have a little bit of a standoff where Chanis, in order to save himself, releases the mule's control over Pritcher, who then immediately would kill the mule, except that Chanis is holding him back. And the mule beats down Chanis. His fleet has gone to Tazenda and annihilated the entire population of Tazenda in order to wipe out the Second Foundation. But Chanis reveals that Tazenda is not the Second Foundation, that it's actually Rossum. And the mule is about to send his fleet to destroy Rossum when who should arrive but the first speaker of the Second Foundation to fight with the mule. He reveals that in fact, neither Tazenda nor Rossum was actually the Second Foundation. And in a moment of doubt and weakness, he's able to enter into the mule and he does something to him, and the mule loses all desire to find the Second Foundation and decides to just go home and live out the rest of his life. as the leader of his empire and not really worry about the Second Foundation anymore. So the Second Foundation wins through the individual intervention of their leader. And then the last scene is Chanis, who had undergone some kind of mental surgery, who wakes up in a hospital and realizes to his shock where the Second Foundation actually is, but he doesn't tell us. So we still don't know. And that's how the first half of Second Foundation ends. So that's the summary of the story. I guess I'll throw it open to, you know, comments from you guys.
Yeah, let me start off with a correction here from something I said last time.
Okay.
I thought that this followed pretty quickly in 1946 after the original parts of the first two parts of The Mule. This was actually not published until January of 1948. So this is basically a full 2 years have gone by in between writing. Yeah, no, I felt like The Mule was a big step forward. I'm not sure this is this. I don't know that this is a step forward. I think Asimov is trying to do some interesting things, but like one of the things that he tried to do, I think sort of falls flat is the, you know, the mental conversation that they're having amongst the members of the Second Foundation. Communicating mentally rather than just having conversations.
Right.
Singles, I don't know, stilted or precious or something.
Well, it does lead to one of the points that I wanted to make, which was that Asimov doesn't seem to be able to decide whether the abilities of the Second Foundationers are innate or whether they're learned. You know, at some points he implies either or both. Certainly their ability to have a conversation mentally has a lot to do with their ability to read each other's facial expressions and body language, so that full speech isn't necessary, that a raised eyebrow or a twitch or you know, anything can communicate. And so they don't really need to they don't really need to speak. But then on the other hand, they do seem to be able to sense each other's at least emotional states from some distance, although they also talk about how it has to be within eyeshot. And also they have the ability to go in and alter. Clearly the first speaker goes in and alters the mule mentally. And so that can't be just a learned ability to read other people's body language. There has to be some real ability to go out and make changes. And so I think as we go through Second Foundation and as we go through you know, the sequels and even in the prequels, we get conflicting information. You know, in the prequels, Harry Seldon actually meets some people who've got what he calls mentalic abilities, where they can, you know, his adopted daughter or granddaughter, I guess, his adopted granddaughter who has this ability, and she meets someone else, and they actually go out and try to find people who have this rare ability. And so it's not clear whether it's a latent organ in the human brain or two organs in the human brain. He never really seemed to reach a final conclusion on that.
Yeah, just one of the interesting things that I noticed is that I think, you know, when one expands to all of the sequels, prequels, expanded universe, you know, the whole thing tying everything together from the robot series through the Galactic Empire through the False Foundation series, the farther one goes along, the more it seems that these psychic abilities kind of tie together the whole grand sweep of things. And those who have read the whole sequence of novels will know what I'm talking about. But it's kind of like in embryonic form, he's talking about these from the beginning. I think the original Mule stories were published in 45. And then I think the first story of his robot series that uses psychic abilities is Liar. And I think that's also published sometime around this, the late mid to late 40s as well. And then this is the story that we read for today is published in 47. So we have all these together, but in early form, when he certainly was not conceiving of these as part of anything like a unified timeline, he's thinking about it as an interest for him in different in different settings. It's kind of natural that it wouldn't all come together 100% seamlessly. He never really does develop a coherent theory of, you know, how psychic abilities work. But I still like it, even though it's kind of a mess. And I concede all the points that you make, John.
Well, I mean, I think also he didn't, even though he had the opportunity when moving from the stories in the magazine form into book form, he didn't really go back and rewrite very much, as Joseph has pointed out
quite a bit.
He pretty much just republished them. And so even when he had the opportunity to rewrite things, he really didn't avail himself of it. And the other thing, of course, is that the mental abilities that the robots have, starting with Lyre and moving forward through Giscard and Ardenio Oliva, who developed those abilities, theirs is much more of a mind reading ability.
They can, I mean,
in Lyre, the robot can read thoughts.
Right.
But does also not have the ability to go reach out and change anything.
That's true.
He can just read thoughts.
Yeah.
Giscard and Daniil developed the ability to do much more like what the Second Foundation does and what the Mule does, which is go out and change people. So that certainly developed over time. I think when you're right, he may have started those two lines of thought very similarly in time, but they were very different at first and got more the same
as he kind of
retconned everything together.
Yeah. Oh, and I'll just jump in and offer a real-time correction of myself. I just Googled it, and Lyre actually was published in 41. So so that was a little bit prior to The Mule by a few years.
There you go.
Yeah, it's sort of interesting, thinking about, because you guys know I've mentioned I'm a big Arthur Clarke fan. I think maybe we all are. And, he's got, that interesting dichotomy that he's known as one of the premier hard science fiction guys, but, he's got the ending of Childhood's End, and he's done all the Arthur Clarke's Mysterious Mysteries or whatever they were called. He really has an interest in metaphysics. And then prior to revisiting that, I'm thinking that Asimov's really the real hard science fiction guy. But here's the, it's a different take on it, but it's the metaphysics again.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Clarke actually felt in later editions of Childhood's End that he had to disclaim the whole ESP thing, that he didn't actually believe in it himself, and that he was just using it as a story element, because so many ESP proponents kind of took Clarke as one of them because of those stories, and he just felt the need to come out and say it's just a story, not actually what I believe.
Yeah, actually, in the front leaf of that book, I believe that there's a statement that basically, the ideas and opinions expressed in this work are not necessarily those of the author.
Another thing that I probably should mention is that interleaved throughout this story, and actually when I read it, some of my favorite parts of the story are the interaction between the first speaker of the Second Foundation and a student who is being brought in. He's a prodigy who's being brought in and basically being groomed for speakership. And for the first time, he's being told the truth. And the truth is that the plan is in absolute shambles, that, he comes back shocked after he's being given an assignment, to kind of analyze the current situation. He's like, well, it's all over, isn't it? We've completely failed. And the first speaker is sort of like, yeah, more or less we have, but now what we're going to do is we're going to wing it. We're going to apply psychohistory to individuals. We're going to try to fix this thing. But the odds are extremely low that we'll be able to do it. And I loved those scenes. I loved those scenes in the room with the Prime Radiant where the plan is being projected up onto the wall. I actually did a book report, I think when I was in sixth grade or something like that. And it was one of those, it wasn't a standard book report. It was one of those things where you had to draw, and I'm not an artist, but I actually tried to do a picture of the Prime Radiant room with the regular plan in black, and then the little red where the people had gone in and made corrections. I just loved those scenes. I really did.
I enjoyed it too. I like, even as a kid, I like being given kind of the inside dope. Like I loved the explanation of how things worked within this, you know, this schema. I like coming back to it as an adult and as a faculty member who has conversations with grad students. The thing that struck me this time around is that he really should have mentioned to the student, by the way, we're not putting any of this in our next grant application.
Now, am I correct that those interludes were in this half of the story and not in the second half of the story? I've confused myself now.
There certainly are.
You confused me as well.
To anyone who's listening who thinks that this episode is disorganized, it's completely my fault. So various reasons, but I'm taking full responsibility for that.
We're a proud anarchy.
Yes.
This is all of us.
We call this, quote, keeping it loose.
Keeping it loose. And that, of course, that whole thing, though, about applying soccer history to individuals and the Second Foundation winging it comes up to another point that I did want to make. Again, as we endlessly and tirelessly go back to the great man theory of history, you know, we've held up the mule as the exception. I think we probably should mention Beta, who single-handedly saved everybody from the mule, as another example of someone whose individual actions mattered. And now even the people who are the guardians of psychohistory are basically trying to manipulate individuals because they have to, they have no choice. You know, the Selden plan really has been completely disrupted by the mule. And the only thing that the Second Foundation can do is throw away their general rule of saying, well, we're only working with the plan, we're only working with the reactions of enormous groups of people, and kind of take on the role of guardians of the plan. And now we're going to do whatever it is we have to do, even if it involves individual action. We just got to do it because no one else is going to do it, and this has to be done. And off they go.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting because, you know, I've been thinking about this is, you know, would psychohistory work as a real mathematical discipline? And I ultimately don't think it does, but it seems to me maybe this is a real missed opportunity here, because clearly there's the you know, we have the tension among the dichotomy that's not really a dichotomy of the, you know, the great man theory versus the bottom up theory, you know. And of course, the answer to any of those easier all things is almost always, no, it's some of both. You know, is regular intelligence important, or is emotional intelligence more important? And it's like, well, no, clearly it's both. You know, that's the only possible answer to this question. Clearly it's both. And so, you know, you have this setup that clearly doesn't stand up to any kind of serious analysis, where you're saying, well, you know, okay, so this guy has made this plan and it's just going to go forward for 1,000 years, right? But Google Maps can tell you, you know, how to get from point A to point B, but you have to be able to adjust the plan if there's an accident or something unforeseen in the middle. And, you know, the Second Foundation, I think, would fit perfectly into that role. They're the trained psychohistorians. They could have been adjusting the plan. I think that might have ultimately made it a lot more realistic. We're not quite getting that.
No, but I could certainly see, it certainly strikes me as realistic that these people would say, okay, look, no one else is going to step up here. Mm-hmm. You know, that there's something important that we've been engaged in for all this time. And regardless of what we think our role is supposed to be, we've just got to be heroes now. You know, we've got to go out and fix this thing, regardless of what our original mandate is.
Let me ask you guys, what do you think about the tension between Hampritcher and Balchanas? This is, I guess we haven't mentioned it yet, but it's sort of like for the mechanics of the plot, it's kind of what drives a lot of the tension of this story along. And this, you know, there's this kind of feeling of, you know, this contrast, right? And we're given a little bit of a peek inside Han Pritchard's head as he is questioning himself and saying, I used to be the young hotshot, and am I feeling jealous of this guy? Am I feeling a little bit miffed at the mule for trusting him to, like, not change him, and yet he felt the need to change me? I'm just I'm wondering whether you like their interactions or find it annoying, or what is your reaction to these two?
Well, I thought it was interesting, but again, it's sort of, you know, because this is the question that's posed at the beginning of the story, right? Is does a controlled mind lose some initiative or some creativity or what have you? You know, it didn't sound like it when the mule was talking about that in Foundation and Empire, but they did kind of set up that question. And then when we find out that Bail Chanis is a member of the Second Foundation, of course, it all becomes moot. And so we never really get any closure on that.
I have to say that I was rooting for Pritchard. I like Pritchard a lot more than I like Bail Chanis. I'm not sure what that means, but I felt bad for Pritchard. I really wanted him to be, I kind of wanted him to win. And I developed a strong dislike for Bail Chanis.
Yeah, I can see that.
Maybe that was intentional. I'm not sure. By the way, I've now looked back at the chapter headings for Second Foundation, and in fact, those interludes are in the second half, not the first half. So so I've completely just destroyed it. You know, all the continuity here.
No. It's foreshadowing.
It's foreshadowing. That's right.
That's right.
But yeah, so that I mean, I had a definite feeling of thinking, you know, who is this guy to come here and screw around with our guy, Hod Pritchard? Who,
yeah,
controlled or not controlled, he's our guy, and I like Hod Pritchard, and I want him to show this kid up. You know, that was 12-year-old me saying I want the kid to be shown up.
Yeah, you know, I think I did too, even as a kid as well. It seems like a normal reading for this, but on the other hand, you know, it's logically right. Hod Pritchard shouldn't be the guy we're rooting for. Like, if we're rooting for the foundation to be restored, I mean, he is a tragic case, to be sure, but he's a traitor as well.
Well, not on purpose.
Not on purpose, right, but still, like, he's, I don't know. Like, I mean, that's one of the fun things about the mule episode. And this is this story has all kinds of flaws, but one of the things that it does well is allow us to kind of have shifting allegiances as readers, right? That is, like, we can be in favor of the full 1,000-year kind of plan for history and still find some pleasure in the human mm-hmm. activities of its antagonists, whether that's Hod Pritchard here or Bell Rios. I was a largely sympathetic character. And, you know, I kind of like that. It's fun. It's something one doesn't always see in sci-fi or other kinds of novels as well. You know, oftentimes I think authors lean very heavily on making us love the hero and hate the enemies. But Asimov doesn't really do that.
So yeah, I have to admit, and this is along the lines of, I think, agreeing with, well, yeah, there's a moment where, you know, Chanis is confronting the mule and he undoes Pritchard's conditioning, and it shocks the mule because he could feel the waves of hatred coming at him. And there is a natural conclusion to the story that would follow from that I would have found far more satisfying than...
Is that where Pritchard tears the mule's head off?
Basically, yeah. basically, right? You know, Chanis is distracting him, and then, you know, he gets to be himself again. And then, you know, the mules, the threat of the mule, or the rule of the mule is ended. I was going to say, in the last section, it just almost reminded me of, like, you know, one of those Marx Brothers cartoon where there's the drug in the glass, and they keep switching the glasses when the other guy turns around. It's like, well, you know, I'm going to win because because you don't know it, but you're on double secret probation. It's like, aha, you know, you're on triple secret probation. And so therefore, you know, I am going to...
Right. A little bit like the Princess Bride with the with the poison. I have to admit also, having not liked Bail Chanis, that when he was revealed as a member of the Second Foundation and then clearly weaker than the mule, I immediately started liking him and started rooting for him. I think as long as Chanis was kind of like the good-looking playboy in-crowd kid, I didn't like him.
Yeah, screw that guy.
And then when he became the underdog, when he has to single-handedly, at least for a little while, try to fight the Buell, all of a sudden he was my friend, you know, and I was rooting for him. So I think, though, Joseph, I also would have probably felt Pritchard was completely justified in anything that he did to the Buell if he'd had the opportunity to do it. And then when the first speaker arrives, he does that manipulation of the Buell. It was a bit anticlimactic. Mm-hmm. I mean, the battle between Chanis and the Buell is tense, and the Buell is almost physically beating him back. Like, he's actually backing up against a wall under the mental onslaught from the Buell. And when the first speaker of the Second Foundation arrives, it's much less intense. And he gets the Buell off balance by telling him that not only was Tazenda not the Second Foundation, but Rossum was not the Second Foundation. And he just slips in, makes the change, and it's over. And it was not anywhere near the kind of high intensity battle that we'd been seeing with Chanis and the Buell. Also, by the way, to get back to the characters that you like and don't like, the Buell, who was a pretty sympathetic character in Foundation and Empire, is not really very sympathetic here. He's kind of cold at first and not likable. And then, you know, he kills an awful lot of people at the end of the story. Asimov kind of glosses over it, but I think at some point he says the population of Tazenda might have been 600 million. And yeah, the Buell is implied to have killed all of them. So
yeah,
that's a lot of people.
That is a global historical tragedy, which is dispatched in a sentence or so. Right. That's incredible level of barbarism, and it's almost shocking how little is made of it. You're right.
Well, it's again one of these things that happens off camera.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure why the Buell would assume that, even if that was the home of the Second Foundation, why murdering everyone on Tazenda would get the whole Second Foundation. Clearly, there are some agents of the Second Foundation not on Tazenda, even if it is the Second Foundation. I mean, Chanis was on Kalgan. There might be other there should be others on Kalgan. I don't know. I guess it's a minor point, but yeah. But the sheer numbers of people that he kills is just pretty high number. And yeah, the Buell is no longer a sympathetic character that he was in the previous book.
Well, he's also how to phrase this, but he's a historical force at this point, rather than a character who's interacting with a limited number of other characters, and that's kind of the extent of it. I think that certainly could make him seem a lot harsher.
Yeah, no, that's true. He's much less of a developed character here. It's strange to see a character undevelop. You know, normally you see characters develop, and he goes from this more nuanced character who, you know, is clearly smitten with Beta and who, you know, is playing this part, and now he's just this sort of Napoleon-like figure. We don't even really know anymore what his motivation is. Like, why does he care about the Second Foundation? And in the first, I mean, Foundation and Empire, it's sort of a revenge motive. You know, it's me against everybody. I don't feel like it was really that strong here. Like, I don't really understand why. I mean, I guess it's an enemy that can stop him, and eventually they do stop him. So he was sort of right to see them as his enemy. And yet, I don't know. I don't really see the. I don't see his motivation so strongly here. Still a good story, though. I admit, reading it, I loved it. I absolutely loved it. And I think that ability of Asimov to manipulate you into first liking one character and then another character, I think that's good writing.
You know, yeah, he absolutely.
He leads you along.
Well, let me just, like, you know, pose a question. You know, because we're saying the Buell is less developed. But, I mean, did we kind of like the Buell in the first part, or did we like Magnifico, who was of course the role he was playing, rather than, we didn't so much see the Buell, we saw the part that he was playing through most of that.
I would say I liked both. I liked the mask of Magnifico, and I also, when he threw aside the mask and he told his story in his own voice, I felt a lot of sympathy for that, for him as well, in himself. That was, it might have been the point at which I liked him the most, even in that first story. I guess, without denying anything that's been said so far, I think part of part of what is just going on here is, you know, we get to spend less time with the mule. He's not at the center of the action, but also it's kind of historically accurate to the way a lot of dictators behave. I mean, there's quite a number of historical figures who seem to be very sympathetic, romantic revolutionaries while they are fighting for power. And maybe at first they have very good intentions. And then when they consolidate power, they become truly terrible. And so, you know, whether or not Asimov was intending that, it fits a pattern of how these people sometimes kind of like work out in real life.
Like in the movie Bananas, you know, where the revolutionary on finally winning the battle
right. Makes
a speech in which he declares that from now on, the official language of the South American country is going to be Swedish. And you have to wear your underwear on the outside and change it three times. You know, you have to change your underwear three times a day and wear it on the outside so we can check on and on, you know, that the power's gone to his head. But I think that's actually a great point. you know, one thing about the mule, he never takes on any title other than first citizen and does not require any honorific other than sir. But if you think the wrong thoughts, he will nail your brain down to where he wants it to be. You know? Yeah, that's an extremely good point. And he lives in that palace by himself. No one ever sees him. I mean, it is a little loony.
Yeah, there were some references in his first story to to a woman that it sounded like would be his wife. And I mean, maybe, and I thought ultimately that would be Beta, but I mean, maybe it was referring to Beta and I read too much into it. I don't remember the exact line.
No, I don't think he had a wife. I mean, he did say to Beta at one point that he could make her his wife.
Right.
He could make her enjoy it, but he didn't do it. But I wanted to go back to this idea of, did we like Magnifico? Because I did like Magnifico. But also, as I think we all kind of figured out that Magnifico was the mule,
yep. He
got more and more sinister as the story developed. And when he killed the crown prince, you were kind of like, you know, huh. And it became more clear that he was playing a part. And as Ebling Miss deteriorated, and it was pretty clear that Magnifico had something to do with that. I mean, it's explicitly revealed at the end that he was driving Miss, but you kind of had that feeling he kept hanging around Miss, and more Miss worked, and the more Magnifico was there, the more emaciated Miss got, and the more he, you know, appeared on the edge of death, and Magnifico was just, you could see that he was doing that. He actually got to be less of a likable character.
That's true. That's absolutely true.
And then you're right, Dan, that when he drops all of that and reveals himself as the mule, he does become sympathetic again. And so again, I mean, it's a nuanced character. There is no single answer. And so I think it was very, very well done. I think that's why we all like Foundation and Empire so much. And you're right, Joseph, here, Joseph or Dan, I'm not sure who was talking about how he's not at the center of action here. And so we don't get much of a chance to see what he's thinking about and what his motivations are. When he finally arrives on the scene at the end, I mean, you can see he really hates the Second Foundation, but we're not 100% sure why. And is willing to kill hundreds of millions of people to eliminate them.
Yeah, well, I mean, they're the enemy. They're the threat. They're the thing that could stop him from having his empire.
Yeah, but so what?
You know? Yeah. I don't know. If you get wrapped up in holding power, which a lot of these guys do.
I mean, the one thing that we do get from him is that he doesn't really get any satisfaction from holding power. He doesn't get any satisfaction from the love that he forces his converted people to have for him. He doesn't have any relationships outside that. I mean, the only relationship we see between him and a non-converted person is with Chanis, who, that's not a friendly relationship. It's not his buddy. It's just the guy who works for him. You know, he's not a happy man. He's not a satisfied man. He's, you know, it's kind of the ultimate, the vacuum that is power, that power for its own sake is worthless. And the mule is really an example of that.
Well said.
Thank you. After screwing up the entire episode, I thought I'd get something profound out there. And then what we're going to do after this is we're going to change gears completely in the second half of this story, which we'll talk about next time, where the whole thing is really told through the eyes of a 14-year-old girl. Beta Daryl's granddaughter, Arcadia, or Arcady, as she likes to be called. And it really is a very strong change in tone from this kind of very heavy, very serious story of the ending of the mule to this kind of whimsical, a story of Arcady and the Foundation's battle against the Second Foundation, including the interludes with the first speaker and the student, which appear in that section, not this section.
Well, that brings this week's episode to a close. Thanks for listening.
We'd like to thank Quinn Blumenfeld for editing the episode. Also, we'd like to credit the music, which is used by a Creative Commons license. It's called It Is Coming by Alex Mason.
Goodbye from the galactic capital of Trantor. This is where the stars end.